Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, does Europe need a nuclear arsenal? We hear from Catholic experts as the review conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty gets underway in New York. And how parents and priests can challenge young people to think hard about the choices they make. Nations are gathered in New York this month to define ways to better check the spread of nuclear arms in today's world. The review conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, resumed Tuesday after hearing from speakers Monday who included Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who reiterated international concern for Tehran's suspected nuclear weapons agenda. In hopes of encouraging other countries to do the same, the United States revealed it possesses an active nuclear arsenal of some 5,000 warheads, a figure that does not include the older weapons slated for dismantling. Iran's president lashed out at the U.S. Monday, saying Washington continues to threaten to use such weapons against other countries, including his. The U.S. Nuclear Posture Review retains the option to use U.S. atomic weapons against countries not in compliance with the Non-Proliferation Pact. The NPT is formally reviewed every 5 years at a meeting of all 189 treaty members. The treaty aims at blocking the spread of nuclear weapons while working to reduce and eventually eliminate them altogether. Well, I recently sat down with a couple of experts in nuclear disarmament. Let's listen. There are more than 25,000 nuclear weapons in the world, thousands of which can be launched within minutes. Recently, we saw the U.S. and Russian leaders sit down and sign a pledge to reduce the number of nuclear missiles in their arsenals. Did they go far enough? 9 countries today possess nuclear weapons. Russia, which possesses a stockpile of approximately up to 16,000 weapons. The U.S., up to about 10,000. China, 400. France, 350. The U.K., 200. Israel's secret program is estimated at up to about 400 weapons. Pakistan, 60 weapons. India, about 45. North Korea, somewhere around 10. Not all of these weapons are located on each of these countries' territories. Some are shared with partner nations which do not possess nuclear arms. So here in Italy, for example, NATO has a small stockpile for what's said is a strong deterrent for aggression. But can we continue to define nuclear arms as a deterrent to war? Can we go so far as to say they're actually a means to preserving peace? Joining me today in studio is Father Paul Lansu of the Brussels-based International Secretariat of the Catholic advocacy group Pax Christi International, who has elaborated an advocacy package for nuclear disarmament that calls for just that, the total elimination of all nuclear arms in today's world. Also joining me today is Velmut Verhagen. Did I pronounce that correctly?
That was right.
Okay. Who is the international campaigner for nuclear disarmament with the Pax Christi in the Netherlands, an ecumenical movement there. So, but I'd like to start with you, Father Paul. Sure. Back in January 2010, Pope Benedict reiterated his call to rid the planet of nuclear arms. And in fact, as part of your peace advocacy within the Catholic Church, you've been taking up that challenge in calling for government accountability and moral responsibility to rid our world of what so easily could become our worst nuclear nightmare.
Yeah, that's right. And we were very happy with the statement of Pope Benedict XVI on the 10th of January in his speech to the diplomatic corps. He focused a lot on the issue of nuclear disarmament, also introducing the need for a successful conference on the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, the so-called NPT Review Conference. And I think the Pope is right in calling governments responsible, especially those governments who possess these weapons of mass destruction, that they take lead in further reducing their arsenals. Some of them do that under the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty Agreement, but some of the other countries who have nuclear weapons are not part of that treaty, and so there's almost no control over these countries. So there is a moral obligation of all involved in this issue that they should reduce their arsenals to what we call a global zero. And we are not the only NGO calling for the global zero. We are supported by many other NGOs within the civil society, and moreover, we are supported by many politicians the last couple of years, so to say. The so-called Gang of Fours, with Henry Kissinger was one of the first and others, in the context of former politicians, former secretary generals of NATO, even like Willy Klaas, the Belgian former secretary general of NATO. These people are calling for, indeed, because of the risks of the use of terrorists, making use of nuclear weapons, etc., and other reasons. There is no reason anymore for these. These people are saying that nuclear weapons should be part of the international policies. They really are calling for a very deep reduction in the direction of global zero. And even in our advocacy package, we have a timeline to come to a certain point. Let's say 2020 should be really the moment that this type of weapons get rid from our planet.
Where does the nuclear security summit in Washington that we saw April 12th through 13th stand in the middle of all of this? And Wilmot, do you think that summit went far enough to reduce the risk of a nuclear catastrophe in today's world?
I wouldn't say it's going far enough as yet. It's been very, very much so an historic conference. It was the first time that an American president called together so many states since the start of the United Nations back in 1945. And what has been done there is the people try to get agreements on how to secure nuclear material, basically the material that makes the bomb go boom.
It's clear that nuclear attributes should be under the control of the International Atomic Energy Agency, based in Vienna. That is the body to have a control over the nuclear capacities. It's also part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But not all the countries have signed that treaty. That is a problem. And there, I think the international community has to take up its responsibility. And it was a good initiative taken by President Obama to bring all these countries together who really care about possible nuclear terrorism. Although that will not be easy to do. It is not easy to get all the bits and pieces together to make at least a mini bomb. That is not easy to do, but theoretically it is possible, and I think it is at the right moment that Obama took this initiative, and we hope that something can come out. And I also hope that it is in a good preparatory moment, just before the coming NPT review conference, that there is a kind of process going on in the direction of better control over nuclear energy and nuclear attributes, and also about the reduction to zero for all nuclear arsenals.
And Obama said that he wants to secure all nuclear materials within the next 4 years, which is quite
ambitious.
But it's very good, and he very much shows his willingness to really get to a world without nuclear weapons.
Now, did U.S. President Obama and the Russian President Medvedev go far enough when, on April 8th, they signed that nuclear arms reduction treaty to cut their stockpiles?
I'm very glad they did so. It's, the first START treaty. I mean, this is a START follow-on treaty. The former one expired in December 2009, and only now we see the new version of this treaty, and they're cutting their arsenals quite significantly. But it's a step, and I'm happy that these steps are now being taken. We really see there's a new momentum with actually current presidents saying that they want a world free of nuclear weapons. It has always been people that were no longer doing their jobs, and then it's so easy to say, I want to work for a nuclear free world. But Obama has done that during his presidency, which is really important. So all those steps are just steps, but they are steps in the right direction, and they are going on the way to zero. And of course, we need to do a whole lot more, and that's why we're within ICAFI Pax Christi and Pax Christi International working towards the global zero and trying to cooperate with states that are willing to go in the same direction.
Yeah, if you look at the concept of proliferation, there are at least two aspects on it. You have the vertical proliferation, the number of arsenals, and you have the horizontal the horizontal proliferation. And on the vertical proliferation, the agreement between Obama and Medvedev is going in a good direction, although their predecessors, Father Bush in 1991 and the Russian president at the time, they also decided to reduce a lot of their strategic nuclear weapons, and that was a lot at the time. So it's not new. And what is new is in fact the climate, the political climate in which that takes place. And that creates a momentum of what is called the window of opportunity. And we should make use of that window of opportunity to go as far as possible. But the problem is, next to the vertical proliferation, is the horizontal proliferation. And there you have control over the five nuclear powers, the five member states of the Security Council. But then you have the whole series of states who are not part of the NPT treaty. And you can mention Israel with tens of nuclear heads. You can mention India, Pakistan, North Korea. And there is, of course, the problem with Iran. What is going on with Iran? And there is a lack of transparency, I think, from their side, what their ambitions are with nuclear energy, etc. And there, the International Atomic Energy Agency plays a very crucial role in having a good control over what is happening with Iran, if the political context is going together. And that's not easy for the people who have to do the job, of course. But we hope that via diplomacy, and there the European Union is trying to do something, and also the Holy See is focusing on a diplomatic solution with the diplomats of Iran to find a good solution in which both partners, both sides, can come to a good, we can call it an agreement on the needs of energy in Iran, and also on the security needs of the international community vis-à-vis Iran.
Do you think that enough has been done to engage Iran and North Korea on nuclear disarmament?
Not enough, and therefore North Korea is not easy to negotiate with. That is also part of another coalition of countries who take care for the contacts with North Korea. Of course, Japan is involved and the USA is involved, and I think also South Korea and some other countries of that part of the world are involved. And in the recent past, there has been diplomatic contacts about the nuclear arsenals in North Korea and the problem that causes in that part of the world. It's up and down, and sometimes the negotiations break down and then they have to start again, and then it is a bilateral context, etc. So it is not easy to handle these things with North Korea, but I think one should focus and should continue the diplomatic efforts with North Korea at the same with Iran.
I'm sure the issue is going to be up there in the headlines quite often, as before 2012, when we see the next nuclear security summit being held in South Korea, North Korea's neighbor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that could be.
I think one thing that that countries could do more than they're doing now is to really show that they are committed to the non-proliferation treaty themselves. Because as long as countries are not upholding their obligations under the treaty so as to work towards disarmament, it's very easy for countries like Iran to say, you know, I can do something now as well. And if countries keep relying on nuclear weapons, it's also easy for Iran to say, you know, if you feel you need nuclear weapons for your existence, why would I not need one? I mean, if you're probably going to attack me, I would need a nuclear weapon to deter you from doing that. And I feel it's very important that countries with nuclear weapons show that they are going to disarm more and more. And part of this is that, like you said, U.S. has tactical nuclear weapons stationed here in Europe in five countries, including Italy. And Russia says, you know, all countries in the world have their nuclear weapons on their own soil. The only country that doesn't have this is the U.S. So as long as the U.S., for example, doesn't take those weapons back onto its own soil, it's very easy, for example, for Russia to say, you know, you first do that before we lower our numbers any further.
Well, in fact, I noticed that as part of your no nukes advocacy, Pax Christi is calling NATO to abandon its nuclear arsenal. But how likely is that if these warheads are considered a deterrent?
You say they're considered a deterrent, and they are in a way. But we know for sure that these weapons stationed here in Europe are militarily obsolete. They're not of any use anymore. They're free-fall bombs that cannot even reach Russia. I mean, these are weapons that were stored there during the Cold War, and at that time they had a function, you could say. At this time, they're not working as a deterrent any longer. They are of a kind of political value still, and that's probably why they're still there. But it also means that it would be a very significant political symbol if these weapons were to be removed from European soil and drawn back into the US, which could then in return spark a reply by Russia by, for example, drawing their tactical nuclear weapons that are on the border, drawing them back to more central locations, more inward.
You know, the presence of these tactical USA nuclear weapons in five Western European countries, including Turkey, is that it is more a symbolic discussion also. And because the use of it is impossible. And I think you can say, and thanks to the civil society also, there's a political consensus in many of these Western European countries that is saying that we really want to get rid of these tactical USA weapons from our soil. And the German government has taken the leadership in this. The new coalition formed in October last year takes the leadership in this, and the Netherlands and Belgium and other countries are following. But of course, the discussion is within NATO as well. And there we hope that the same countries we are talking about, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, Italy and Turkey, take also the political lead in the NATO context, because they are in a process of reviewing NATO's strategic nuclear strategic concept, that they also take the leadership and that they take a courageous position indeed to not only to plea for that takeaway of these arsenals, but that they even come to the conclusion that NATO doesn't need a strategic concept that is dealing with nuclear weapons, because they are not usable.
And it's important to realize that those weapons are being seen as the glue of the alliance, the glue that glues together Europe and European and American security. So there has been a stalemate for quite some time where the US says, we're not going to withdraw those weapons because that would be rude to our European partners and they might not feel secure anymore. Whereas the European people say, you know, we cannot do away with those weapons because we don't want to be rude towards President Obama. Now we see that Germany has indeed taken the lead in trying to get rid of those weapons. And it's very important that countries in Europe, the five where they are stored, but also all the other countries, specifically the ones in Central and Eastern Europe, signal to the US that they don't need those tactical nuclear weapons stored in Europe to feel secure, secured by the United States of America. And when they proclaim this, then it will be much easier for President Obama to take these weapons away.
I'd like to go back to what we were talking about before, the Catholic Church's role in all of this, and also, can we continue to define nuclear arms as a deterrent to war? Can we go so far to say that they're actually a means to preserving peace?
As Pax Christi International, we stated already in several statements that from a moral point of view, these weapons are not cannot be used. You cannot use it as a deterrence, and it is not ethical responsible to produce these weapons. I'm sure that the Holy See is very close to that as well. Since 1982, Pope John Paul II formulated the following wording, that nuclear deterrence can be still accepted under the condition that there is a progressive disarmament of these weapons, so that there is a kind of an avenue in the direction of a reduction to zero. And that didn't happen enough.
Nowadays, more and more people come to realize that in these days where wars are happening more within countries than between and terrorism is a real threat, it's important to realize that nuclear weapons pose more of a security threat than a security insurance.
And a warm thanks there to my guests, Wilmut Verhagen, international campaigner for nuclear disarmament for Pax Christi Netherlands, and Father Paul Lansu from the International Secretariat of Pax Christi International. As a parent, I know it's not easy to guide kids through the stormy waters and perilous pitfalls that they encounter as they grow up in an increasingly secular and consumerist world. Temptations like drugs, alcohol, sex, even crime. It's difficult for any parent to lay down a law that can so easily or secretly be circumvented by a rebellious child who figures mom's just being old-fashioned. Well, I asked Father Bernie O'Connor, an official with the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches, how parents and priests, for that matter, can challenge young people to think carefully about the choices they make and act responsibly.
I'm reminded of a story which is told, oh, it's hundreds of years old, about Ignatius of Loyola. And he encountered this nice young man on the steps of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And they were chit-chatting, and the comment was made, what are you going to do with your life? And the young fellow said, well, I'm going to go to university and study. And then what? Well, I think I'll become a lawyer, perhaps even a judge. And then what? Well, I will marry and I will try to get politically involved. And then what? Oh, and the fellow got very upset. I'll grow old and I'll die. To which Ignatius said, and then what? The young man's name, by the way, was Francis Xavier. Very interesting that in our interactions with young people, I think there's two things we're forgetting. One of them is the idealism of youth, and the other is the realism of youth. I look at the Obama campaign, the election, and how many thought that by making a radical choice, the world would change. By my putting in that man, the political scene worldwide would change and everything would be cured of the years of the Bush administration. That was the popular perception in Europe. But it was the rhetoric of the young who believed that almost for the first time in their life, they were actually affecting political and social change. Well, the truth of that reality and the reliability of their interpretation is still being critiqued and still being challenged. But I think what the church can learn from all of this is that those surveys, for example, which indicate that the young are departing our ranks in huge numbers, but still think of themselves as spiritual, though not religious, or as spiritual and religious, but not in a formal way. Let's examine that. What does that mean? And is there any manner in which, in our conversation with young, we can help them ask, what does it mean for me to be spiritual? What do they have in mind with that? Is there any way we can tap into it? Young people tell me constantly, oh, I'm spiritual. But when I press them on the point, and then what, like Ignatius to Xavier, they get exasperated and frustrated because their own idealism and their own realism, they have no answer to it. They're both areas of their life are completely without answer. And sometimes the greatest gift we can give a young person is to point out that fact to them very gently. You profess being spiritual, but I'm sorry, I don't understand you. That's incoherent. You profess being spiritual and open to your fellow man, but I don't see anything different than a very self-interested kind of agenda, which is anything but charity. Tell me what you mean. I remember one time a priest, an elderly priest, saying to me, you know, Bernie, I've learned in ministry that the best way to get people's attention is to say, I need help and I don't know what to do. When you pretend or convey that you have all the answers and all the solutions, they run away. But when you say, I don't understand, can you help me? Youth particularly are very eager to come to the door and say, I heard you need some assistance with your computer. I'm good at computers. Excellent. Let's look at that. And then you talk. Most young people will tell you of their disillusionment and anger and frustration with the church. The advice I give to clergy is don't be defensive. If that's their experience and that's their position, hear it and ask why. And then probe their idealism, their realism, rather along the line of St. Ignatius with Xavier. There's a lot of hope in this, but let's not be afraid when young people say, we need something new and different. Fine, let's create it.
Just that we hope that it won't be drugs or premarital sex or alcohol.
And there's no question that those influences within our society have exerted their toll, no question about it. And for many young people, the church is absolutely inept and incapable of contributing to their lives. And if that's the impression we've left them with, I pray God it's not the impression we will continue to leave them with. I'm going to give you an example. I have a little formula that I recommend to persons entering marriage. And I tell them this is Father Bernie's anti-divorce formula. And they laugh at me and they twitter and have a great little time. I say I have a little program, takes about 15 minutes a day. And if you do it, chances are you won't end up in the divorce court. And people say, Bernie, what is it? Quick, what is it? At the end of every day, one spouse looks at the other mutually and they have three questions for each other. Have I hurt you today? Let's talk about that. Have I been a blessing in any way to you today? Let's talk about that. And has the face of God been shown in our relationship to us this day? These are tough questions, and they can become routine mighty fast. I find with many young people to whom I speak, the person they're living with for that particular moment in their lives, they're into serial monogamy, a number of them, can't ask those questions. And they'll say, oh, Father Bernie, don't be so foolish. That's unrealistic. It's idealistic. It's pious. I say, yes. But it's also the reality that if you're going to take relationships seriously, I'm here to try to help you by my experience of relationships to help you look at yours and what you mean by relationship. Very honestly, many young people haven't the foggiest notion of what commitment entails. It's simply randomness and immediate preference. And my obligation is to say, let's not lie to ourselves, which are the greatest lies we'll ever tell, but let's look at each other straight in the eye and be able to say, who are we and who is God for us, without pretense and without the veneer of what amounts to theater. There's a challenge. You know, during the marriage ceremony, when I officiated a marriage, publicly I give the couple a number of gifts. These are personal. They're not from the parish. They're from me. I always present them with the Bible from which their nuptial liturgy readings were read, proclaimed. And I inscribe it with a reference to the readings that were chosen for their liturgy. And I write it in the Bible, given to this couple this day, in the hope that you will regularly reread the texts that were chosen for your liturgy. I also give them a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And I give them a subscription to some readable information magazine or journal to come to the home that will keep them updated about basic Catholic teaching, Catholic Digest or something of that nature. And I make this publicly to try to convey that the Word of God in Scripture and the Word of God within our church tradition speaks today. If we welcome it and not merely allow the church to be a theater piece because the pictures will turn out nice for our ceremony, but rather to say that this liturgy celebrates a commitment. Commitment is tough stuff, but together it can be the most exhilarating, fulfilling, satisfying, and joyful reality that's on the face of the earth.
And a warm thanks there to Father Bernie O'Connor, an official with the Pontifical Congregation for Eastern Churches. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.